Maya found herself unable to mention her sighting to anyone, and in a way this was more frightening than the incident itself, as it emphasized to her its impossibility. People would think she had gone mad. What other conclusion was there? How would he eat? Where would he hide? No, too many people would have to know. It really wasn't possible. But that face! One night she saw it again in a dream and woke up in a sweat. Hallucination was one of the symptoms of space breakdown, as she well knew. It happened fairly frequently during long stays in Earth orbit. A couple of dozen incidences had been recorded. Usually people started by hearing voices in the ever-present background noise of ventilation and machinery, but a fairly common alternative was the sighting of a workmate who wasn't there, or worse yet, of a doppelganger, as if empty space had begun to fill with mirrors. Shortage of sensory stimuli was believed to cause the phenomena, and the Ares, with its long voyage and no Earth to look at, and a brilliant and, some might say, driven crew, had been judged a potential hazard. This was one of the main reasons the ship's rooms had been given so much variety of color and texture, along with changing daily and seasonal weather, and still she had seen something that couldn't be there. And now when she walked through the ship, it seemed to her that the crew was breaking up into small and private groups, groups that rarely interacted. The farm team spent almost all its time in the farms, even eating meals there on the floors, and sleeping, together, rumor had it, among the rows of plants. The medical team had its own suite of rooms and offices and labs in Taurus B, and they spent their time in there, absorbed with experiments and observations and consultations with Earth. The flight team was preparing for MOI, running several simulations a day, and the rest were scattered, hard to find. As she walked around the Tauruses, the room seemed emptier than ever before. The D dining hall was never full anymore, and then again in the separated clumps of diners that were there, she noticed arguments broke out fairly frequently and were hushed with peculiar speed. Private spats, but about what? Maya herself said less at table and listened more. You could tell a lot about a society by what topics of conversation came up. In this crowd, the talk was almost always science. Shop talk. Biology, engineering, geology, medicine, whatever. You could chat forever about that stuff. But when the number of people in a conversation fell below 4, she noticed, the topics of conversation tended to change. Shop talk was augmented or replaced entirely by gossip, and the gossip was always about those two great forms of the social dynamic, sex and politics. Voices lowered, heads leaned in, and word got around. Rumors about sexual relations were becoming more common and more quiet, more caustic and more complex. In a few cases, as in the unfortunate triangle of Janet Blylevin, Mary Dunkel, and Alex Jalin, it went very public and became the talk of the ship. In others, it stayed so hidden that the talk was in whispers, accompanied by pointed, inquisitive glances. Janet Blylevin would walk into the dining hall with Roger Calkins, and Frank would remark to John, in an undertone meant to reach Maya's ears, "Janet thinks we're a panmixia." Maya would ignore him, as she always did when he spoke in that sneery tone of voice, but later she looked up the word in a sociobiology lexicon and found that a panmixia was a group where every male mated with every female. The next day, she looked at Janet curiously. She had no idea. Janet was friendly. She leaned in at you as you talked and really paid attention, and she had a quick smile, but... well, the ship had been built to ensure a lot of privacy. No doubt there was more happening than anyone could know. And among these secret lives, might there not be another secret life, led in solitude, or in teamwork with some few among them, some small clique or cabal? "Have you noticed anything funny lately?" she asked Nadia one day at the end of their regular breakfast chat. Nadia shrugged. "People aboard... It's about time to get there, I think. Maybe that was all it was. Nadia said, Did you hear about Hiroko and Arkady? Rumors were constantly swirling about Hiroko. Maya found it distasteful, disturbing, that the lone Asian woman among them should be the focus of that kind of thing. Dragon Lady, Mysterious Orient. Underneath the scientific rational surfaces of their minds, there were so many deep and powerful superstitions. Anything might happen. Anything was possible. Like a face seen through a glass. And so she listened with a tight feeling in her stomach as Sasha Yefremov leaned over from the next table and responded to Nadia's question by wondering if Hiroko were developing a male harem. That was nonsense. Although an alliance of some sort between Hiroko and Arkady had an unsettling sort of logic to Maya, she wasn't sure why. Arkady was very open in advocating independence from mission control. Hiroko never talked about it at all. But in her actions, hadn't she already led the whole farm team away into a mental Taurus the others could never enter? But then when Sasha claimed in a low voice that Hiroko had plans to fertilize several of her own ova with sperm from all the men on the Ares and store them cryonically for later growth on Mars, Maya could only sweep up her tray and head for the dishwashers, feeling something like vertigo. They were becoming strange. The red crescent grew to the size of a quarter, and the feeling of tension grew as well, as if it were the hour before a thunderstorm, and the air charged with dust and creosote and static electricity. As if the god of war were really up there on that blood dot, waiting for them. The green wall panels inside the Ares were now flecked with yellow and brown, and the afternoon light was thick with sodium vapor's pale bronze. People spent hours in the bubble dome, watching what none among them but John had seen before. The exercise machines were in constant use, the simulations performed with renewed enthusiasm. Janet took a swing through the Tauruses, sending back video images of all the changes in their little world. Then she threw her glasses on a table and resigned her post as reporter. "Look, I'm tired of being an outsider," she said. "Every time I walk into a room, everyone shuts up or starts preparing their official line. It's like I was a spy for an enemy."
"You were,"
Arkady said, and gave her a big hug. At first, no one volunteered to take over her job. Houston sent messages of concern, then reprimands, then veiled threats. Now that they were about to reach Mars, the expedition was getting a lot more TV time, and the situation was about to go Nova, as Mission Control put it. They reminded the colonists that this burst of publicity would eventually reap the space program all kinds of benefits. The colonists had to film and broadcast what they were doing to stimulate public support for the later Mars missions on which they were going to depend. It was their duty to transmit their stories. Frank got on the screen and suggested that Mission Control could concoct their video reports out of footage from robot cameras. Hastings, head of Mission Control in Houston, was visibly infuriated by this response. But as Arkady said, with a grin that extended the realm of the question to everything, "What can they do?" Maya shook her head. They were sending a bad signal and revealing what the video reports had so far hidden, that the group was splintering into rival cliques, which indicated Maya's own lack of control over the Russian half of the expedition. She was about to ask Nadia to take over the reporting job as a favor to her when Phyllis and some of her friends in Taurus B volunteered for the job. Maya, laughing at the expression on Arkady's face, gave it to them. Arkady pretended not to care. Irritated, Maya said in Russian, "You know you've missed a chance. A chance to shape our reality, in effect."
"Not our reality, Maya. Their reality. And I don't care what they think."
Maya and Frank began conferring about landfall assignments. To a certain extent, these were predetermined by the crew members' areas of expertise, but because of all the skill redundancies, there were still some choices to be made. And Arkady's provocations had had this effect, at least.
Mission Control's pre-flight plans were now generally regarded as provisional at best. In fact, no one seemed all that inclined to acknowledge Maya or Frank's authority either, which made things tense when it became known what they were working on. Mission Control's pre-flight plan called for the establishment of a base colony on the plains north of Ophir Chasma, the enormous northern arm of Valles Marineris. All the farm team was assigned to the base, and a majority of the engineers and medical people, altogether around 60 of the 100. The rest would be scattered on subsidiary missions, returning to the base camp from time to time. The largest subsidiary mission was to dock a part of the disassembled Ares on Phobos and begin transforming that moon into a space station. Another, smaller mission would leave the base camp and travel north to the polar cap to build a mining system which would transport blocks of ice back to the base. A third mission was to make a series of geological surveys, traveling all over the planet, a glamour assignment for sure. All the smaller groups would become semi-autonomous for periods of up to a year, so selecting them was no trivial matter. They knew well now how long a year could be. Arkady and a group of his friends, Alex, Roger, Samantha, Edvard, Janet, Tatiana, Elena, requested all the jobs on Phobos. When Phyllis and Mary heard about it, they came to Maya and Frank to protest. "They're obviously trying to take over Phobos, and who knows what they'll do with it." Maya nodded, and she could see Frank didn't like it either. The problem was no one else wanted to stay on Phobos. Even Phyllis and Mary weren't clamoring to replace Arkady's crew, so it wasn't clear how to oppose him. Louder arguments broke out when Anne Claiborne passed around her crew list for the geological survey. A lot of people wanted to join that one, and several of those left off her list said they were going on surveys whether Anne wanted them or not. Arguments became frequent and vehement. Almost everyone aboard declared themselves for one mission or another, positioning themselves for the final decisions. Maya felt that she was losing all control of the Russian contingent. She was getting furious at Arkady. In a general meeting, she suggested sarcastically that they let the computer make the assignments. The idea was rejected with no regard for her authority. She threw up her hands. "Then what do we do?" No one knew. She and Frank conferred in private. "Let's try giving them the illusion of making the decision," he said to her with a brief smile. She realized that he wasn't displeased to have seen her fail in the general meeting. Their encounter was coming back to haunt her, and she cursed herself for a fool. Little politburos were dangerous. Frank polled everyone concerning their wishes, and then displayed the results on the bridge, listing everyone's first, second, and third choices. The geological surveys were popular, while staying on Phobos was not. Everyone already knew this, and the posted lists proved that there were fewer conflicts than it had seemed. "There are complaints about Arkady taking over Phobos," Frank said at the next public meeting. "But no one but him and his friends want that job. Everyone else wants to get down to the surface." Arkady said, "In fact, we should get hardship compensation." "It's not like you to talk about compensation, Arkady," Frank said smoothly. Arkady grinned and sat back down. Phyllis wasn't amused. "Phobos will be a link between Earth and Mars, like the space stations in Earth orbit. You can't get from one planet to the other without them. They're what naval strategists call choke points." "I promise to keep my hands off your neck," Arkady said to her. Frank snapped, "We're all going to be part of the same village. Anything we do affects all of us. And judging by the way you're acting, dividing up from time to time will be good for us. I, for one, wouldn't mind having Arkady out of my sight for a few months." Arkady bowed. "Phobos, here we come." But Phyllis and Mary and their crowd still weren't happy. They spent a lot of time conferring with Houston, and whenever Maya went into Taurus B, conversations seemed to cease. Eyes followed her suspiciously, as if being Russian would automatically put her in Arkady's camp.
She damned them for fools, and damned Arkady even more. He had started all this. But in the end, it was hard to tell what was going on, with 100 people scattered in what suddenly felt like such a large ship. Interest groups, micropolitics, they were really fragmenting. 100 people only, and yet they were too large a community to cohere. And there was nothing she or Frank could do about it. One night she dreamed again of the face in the farm. She woke shaken and was unable to fall back asleep, and suddenly everything seemed out of control. They flew through the vacuum of space inside a small knot of linked cans, and she was supposed to be in charge of this mad argosy. It was absurd. She left her room, climbed Dee's spoke tunnel to the central shaft. She pulled herself to the bubble dome, forgetting the tunnel jump game. It was 4 a.m. The inside of the bubble dome was like a planetarium after the audience has gone, silent, empty, with thousands of stars packed into the black hemisphere of the dome. Mars hung directly overhead, gibbous and quite distinctly spherical, as if a stone orange had been tossed among the stars. The 4 great volcanoes were visible pockmarks, and it was possible to make out the long rifts of Marineris. She floated under it, spread-eagled and spinning very slightly, trying to comprehend it, trying to feel something specific in the dense interference pattern of her emotions. When she blinked, little spherical teardrops floated out and away among the stars. The locked door opened. John Boone floated in, saw her, grabbed the door handle to stop himself. "Oh, sorry. Mind if I join you?" "No." Maya sniffed and rubbed her eyes. "What gets you up at this hour?"
"I'm often up early. And you?"
"Bad dreams."
"Of what?"
"I can't remember," she said, seeing the face in her mind. He pushed off, floated past her to the dome.
"I can never remember my dreams."
"Never?"
"Well, rarely. If something wakes me up in the middle of one, and I have time to think about it, then I might remember it, for a little while anyway."
"That's normal. But it's a bad sign if you never remember your dreams at all."
"Really? What's it a symptom of?"
"Of extreme repression, I seem to recall."
She had drifted to the side of the dome. She pushed off through the air, stopped herself against the dome next to him.
"But that may be Freudianism."
"In other words, something like the theory of phlogiston." She laughed.
"Exactly."
They looked out at Mars, pointed out features to each other, talked. Maya glanced at him as he spoke.
Such bland, happy good looks. He really was not her type. In fact, she had taken his cheeriness for a kind of stupidity back at the beginning. But over the course of the voyage, she had seen that he was not stupid. "What do you think of all the arguments about what we should do up there?" she asked, gesturing at the red stone ahead of them.
"I don't know."
"I think Phyllis makes a lot of good points."
He shrugged. "I don't think that matters."
"What do you mean?"
"The only part of an argument that really matters is what we think of the people arguing. X claims A, Y claims B. They make arguments to support their claims with any number of points. But when their listeners remember the discussion, what matters is simply that X believes A and Y believes B. People then form their judgment on what they think of X and Y."
"But we're scientists. We're trained to weigh the evidence."
John nodded.
"True.
In fact, since I like you, I concede the point." She laughed and pushed him, and they tumbled down the sides of the dome, away from each other. Maya, surprised at herself, arrested her motion against the floor. She turned and saw John coming to a halt across the dome, landing against the floor. He looked at her with a smile, caught a rail, and launched himself into the air, across the domed space, on a course aimed at her.
Instantly, Maya understood, and forgetting completely her resolution to avoid this kind of thing, she pushed off to intercept him. They flew directly at each other, and to avoid a painful collision, had to catch and twist in midair as if dancing. They spun, hands clasped, spiraling up slowly toward the dome. It was a dance, with a clear and obvious end to it, there to reach whenever they liked. Phew! Maya's pulse raced, and her breath was ragged in her throat. As they spun, they tensed their biceps and pulled together, as slowly as docking spacecraft, and kissed. With a smile, John pushed down from her, sending her flying to the dome and him to the floor, where he caught and crawled to the chamber's hatch. He locked it. Maya let her hair loose and shook it out so it floated around her head, across her face. She shook it wildly and laughed. It wasn't as though she felt on the verge of any great or overmastering love. It was simply going to be fun, and that feeling of simplicity was... She felt a wild surge of lust and pushed off the dome toward John. She tucked into a slow somersault, unzipping her jumper as she spun, her heart pounding like timpani, all her blood rushing to her skin, which tingled as if thawing as she undressed, banged into John, flew away from him after an overhasty tug at a sleeve. They bounced around the chamber as they got their clothes off, miscalculating angles and momentums until, with a gentle thrust of the big toes, they flew into each other and met in a spinning embrace and floated kissing among their floating clothes. In the days that followed, they met again. They made no attempt to keep the relationship a secret, so very quickly they were a known item, a public couple. Many aboard seemed taken aback by the development, and one morning Maya walked into the dining hall and caught a swift glance from Frank, seated at a corner table, that chilled her. It reminded her of some other time, some incident, some look on his face that she couldn't quite call to mind. But most of those aboard seemed pleased. After all, it was a kind of royal match, an alliance of the two powers behind the colony, signifying harmony. Indeed, the union seemed to catalyze a number of others, which either came out of the closet or, in the newly supersaturated medium, sprang into being. Vlad and Ursula, Dmitri and Elena, Raoul and Marina. Newly evident couples were everywhere, to the point where the singletons among them began to make nervous jokes about it. But Maya thought she noticed less tension in voices, fewer arguments, more laughter. One night, lying in bed thinking about it, thinking of wandering over to John's room, she wondered if that was why they had gotten together. Not from love. She still didn't love him. She felt no more than friendship for him, charged by lust that was strong but impersonal. But because it was, in fact, a very useful match. Useful to her. But she swerved from that thought, concentrated on the match's usefulness to the expedition as a whole. Yes, it was politic. Like feudal politics or the ancient comedies of spring and regeneration. And it felt that way, she had to admit. As if she were acting in response to imperatives stronger than her own desires, acting out the desires of some larger force, of perhaps Mars itself. It was not an unpleasant feeling. As for the idea that she might have gained leverage over Arkady or Frank or Hiroko, well, she successfully avoided thinking about that. It was one of Maya's talents. Blooms of yellow and red and orange spread across the walls. Mars was now the size of the moon in Earth's sky. It was time to harvest all their effort. Only a week more, and they would be there. There was still tension over the unsolved problems of landfall assignments, and now Maya found it less easy than ever to work with Frank. It was nothing obvious, but it occurred to her that he didn't dislike their inability to control the situation, because the disruptions were being caused more by Arkady than anyone else, and so it looked like it was more her fault than his. More than once she left a meeting with Frank and went to John, hoping to get some kind of help. but John stayed out of the debates and threw his support behind everything that Frank proposed. His advice to Maya in private was fairly acute, but the trouble was he liked Arkady and disliked Phyllis. So often he recommended to her that she support Arkady, apparently unaware of the way this tended to undercut her authority among the other Russians. She never pointed this out to him, however. Lovers or not, there were still areas she didn't wish to discuss with him, or with anyone else. But one night in his room, her nerves were jangling, and lying there, unable to sleep, worrying about first this, then that, she said, "Do you think it would be possible to hide a stowaway on the ship?" "Well, I don't know," he said, surprised. "Why do you ask?" Swallowing hard, she told him about the face through the algae bottle. He sat up in bed, staring at her. "You're sure it wasn't..." "It wasn't any of us." He rubbed his jaw. "Well, I suppose if he were getting help from someone in the crew..." "Hiroko," Maya suggested. "I mean, not just because she's Hiroko, but because of the farm and all that. It would solve his food problem, and there's a lot of places to hide there, and he could have taken shelter with the animals during the radiation storm."
"They got a lot of rems."
"But he could have gotten behind their water supply. A little one-man shelter wouldn't be too hard to set up." John still hadn't gotten over the idea of it. 9 months in hiding. It's a big ship. It could be done, right?
"Well, I suppose so."
"Yeah, it could, I guess. But why?"
Maya shrugged.
"I have no idea. Someone who wanted on, who didn't make the selection. Someone who had a friend or friends.
Still, I mean, a lot of us had friends who wanted to come. That doesn't mean that..."
"I know, I know."
They talked about it for most of an hour, discussing the possible reasons, the methods that could have been used to slip a passenger on board, to hide him, and so on. And then Maya suddenly noticed that she felt much better, that she was, in fact, in a wonderful mood. John believed her. He didn't think she had gone crazy. She felt a wash of relief and happiness and threw her arms around him.
"It's so good to be able to talk to you about this."
He smiled. "We're friends, Maya. You should have brought it up before."
"Yes."
The bubble dome would have been a wonderful place to view their final approach to Mars, but they were going to be aerobraking to reduce speed, and the dome would be behind the heat shield that they now deployed. There would be no view. Aerobraking saved them from the necessity of carrying the enormous amount of fuel it would have taken to slow down, but it was an extremely precise operation and therefore dangerous. They had a leeway of less than a millisecond of arc, and so several days before MOI, the navigation team began to tweak their course with small burns on an almost hourly basis, fine-tuning the approach. Then, as they got closer, they stopped the ship's rotation. The return to weightlessness, even in the Tauruses, was a shock. Suddenly it came home to Maya that it wasn't just another simulation. She lofted through the windy air of the hallways, seeing everything from a strange new high perspective, and all of a sudden it felt real. She slept in snatches, an hour here, 3 hours there. Every time she stirred, floating in her sleeping bag, she had a moment of disorientation, thinking she was in Novi Mir again. Then she would remember, and adrenaline would knock her awake. She would pull through the halls of the Taurus, pushing off the wall panels of brown and gold and bronze. On the bridge, she would check with Mary or Raoul or Marina or someone else in navigation. Everything still on course. They were approaching Mars so quickly it seemed they could see it expanding on the screens. They had to miss the planet by 30 kilometers, or about 1/10 millionth of the distance they had traveled. "No problem," Mary said, with a quick glance at Arkady. So far they were on the Mantra run, and hopefully none of his mad problems would crop up. The crew members not involved with navigation worked to batten down, preparing everything for the torque and bumps that 2.5 G's were sure to bring.
Some of them got to go out on EVAs to deploy subsidiary heat shields and the like. There was a lot to do, and yet the days seemed long anyway. It was going to happen in the middle of the night, and so that evening all the lights stayed on, and no one went to bed. Everyone had a station, some on duty, most of them only waiting it out. Maya sat in her chair on the bridge, watching the screens and the monitors, thinking that they looked just like they would if it were all a simulation in Baikonur. Could they really be going into orbit around Mars? They could. The Ares hit Mars's thin high atmosphere at 40,000 kilometers per hour, and instantly the ship was vibrating heavily, Maya's chair shaking her fast and hard, and there was a faint low roar as if they flew through a blast furnace, and it looked like that too, because the screens were bursting with an intense pink-orange glow. Compressed air was bouncing off the heat shields and blazing past all the exterior cameras so that the whole bridge was tinged the color of Mars. Then gravity returned with a vengeance. Maya's ribs were squeezed so hard that she had trouble breathing, and her vision was blurred. It hurt. They were plowing through the thin air at a speed and height calculated to put them into what aerodynamicists called transitional flow, a state halfway between free molecular flow and continuum flow. Free molecular flow would have been the preferred mode of travel, with the air that struck the heat shield shoved to the sides and the resulting vacuum refilled mostly by molecular diffusion. But they were moving too fast for that, and they could only just barely avoid the tremendous heat of continuum flow, in which air would have moved over shield and ship as part of a wave action. The best they could do was to take the highest possible course that would slow them enough, and this put them into transitional flow, which vacillated between free molecular and continuum flow, making for a bumpy ride. And there lay the danger. If they were to hit a high-pressure cell in the Martian atmosphere, where heat or vibration or G-forces caused some sensitive mechanism to break, then they could be cast into one of Arkady's nightmares at the very time they were crushed in their chairs, weighing 400 pounds apiece, which was something Arkady had never been able to simulate very well. In the real world, Maya thought grimly, at the moment when they were most vulnerable to danger, they were also most helpless to deal with it. But as fate would have it, Martian stratospheric weather was stable, and they remained on the Mantra Run, which in actuality turned out to be a roaring, shuddering, breath-robbing 8 minutes. No hour Maya could remember had lasted as long. Sensors showed that the main heat shield had risen to 600 degrees Kelvin. And then the vibration stopped. The roar ended. They had skipped out of the atmosphere after skidding around a quarter of the planet. They had decelerated by some 20,000 kilometers an hour, and the heat shield's temperature had risen to 710 degrees Kelvin, very near its limit. But the method had worked. All was still. They floated, weightless again, held down by their chair straps. It felt as if they had stopped moving entirely, as if they were floating in pure silence. Unsteadily, they unstrapped themselves, floated like ghosts around the cool air of the rooms, an airy, faint roaring sounding in their ears, emphasizing the silence. They were talking too loudly, shaking each other's hands. Maya felt dazed, and she couldn't understand what people were saying to her, not because she couldn't hear them, but because she wasn't paying attention. 12 weightless hours later, their new course led them to a periapsis 35,000 kilometers from Mars. There they fired the main rockets for a brief thrust, increasing their speed by about 100 kilometers an hour. After that, they were pulled toward Mars again, carving an ellipse that would bring them back to within 500 kilometers of the surface. They were in Martian orbit. Each elliptical orbit of the planet took around a day. Over the next 2 months, the computers would control burns that would gradually circularize their course just inside the orbit of Phobos. But the landing parties were going to descend to the surface well before that, while perigee was so close. They moved the heat shields back to their storage positions and went inside the bubble dome to have a look. During perigee, Mars filled most of the sky as if they flew over it in a high jet. The depth of Valles Marineris was perceptible, the height of the four big volcanoes obvious. Their broad peaks appeared over the horizon well before the surrounding countryside came into view. There were craters everywhere on the surface. Their round interiors were a vivid sandy orange, a slightly lighter color than the surrounding countryside. Dust, presumably. The short, rugged, curved mountain ranges were darker than the surrounding countryside, a rust color broken by black shadows, but both the light and dark colors were just a shade away from the omnipresent rusty orangish red, which was the color of every peak, crater, canyon, dune, and even the curved slice of the dust-filled atmosphere, visible high above the bright curve of the planet. Red Mars. It was transfixing, mesmerizing. Everyone felt it. They spent long hours working, and at last it was real work. The ship had to be partially disassembled. The main body would be eventually parked in orbit near Phobos and used as an emergency return vehicle. But 20 tanks from the outer lengths of the hub shaft had only to be disconnected from the Ares and prepped to become planetary landing vehicles, which would take the colonists down in groups of five. The first lander was scheduled to descend as soon as it was decoupled and prepped, so they worked in round-the-clock shifts, spending a lot of time in EVA. They pulled into the dining halls tired and ravenous, and conversations were loud. The ennui of the voyage seemed forgotten. One night Maya floated in the bathroom getting ready for bed, feeling stiffened muscles that she hadn't heard from in months. Around her, Nadia and Sasha and Yeli Zudov were chattering away, and in the warm wash of voluble Russian, it suddenly occurred to her that everyone was happy. They were in the last moment of their anticipation, an anticipation that had lain in their hearts for half a lifetime, or ever since childhood, and now suddenly it had bloomed below them like a child's crayon drawing of Mars, growing huge, then small, and as it yo-yoed back and forth, it loomed before them in all its immense potential. Tabula rasa, blank slate. A blank red slate. Anything was possible. Anything could happen. In that sense, they were, in just these last few days, perfectly free. Free of the past, free of the future, weightless in their own warm air, floating like spirits about to invest a material world. In the mirror, Maya caught sight of the toothbrush-distorted grin on her face and grabbed a railing to hold her position. It occurred to her that they might never be so happy again. Beauty was the promise of happiness, not happiness itself. And the anticipated world was often more rich than anything real. But this time, who could say? This time might be the golden one at last. She released the railing and spit toothpaste into a wastewater bag, then floated backward into the hallway. Come what may, they had reached their goal. They had earned at least the chance to try. Disassembling the Ares made a lot of them feel odd. It was, as John remarked, like dismantling a town and flinging the houses in different directions. And this was the only town they had. Under the giant eye of Mars, all their disagreements became taut. Clearly it was critical now. There was little time left. People argued in the open or under the surface. So many little groups now, keeping their own counsel. What had happened to that brief moment of happiness? Maya blamed it mostly on Arkady. He had opened Pandora's box. If not for him and his talk, would the farm group have drawn so close around Hiroko? Would the medical team have kept such close counsel? She didn't think so. She and Frank worked hard to reconcile differences and forge a consensus, to give them the feeling they were still a single team. It involved long conferences with Phyllis and Arkady, Anne and Sax, Houston and Baikonur. In the process, a relationship developed between the two leaders that was even more complex than their early encounters in the park, though that was part of it. Maya saw now, in Frank's occasional flashes of sarcasm, of resentment, that he had been bothered by the incident more than she had thought at the time. But there was nothing to be done about it now. In the end, the Phobos mission was indeed given to Arkady and his friends, mainly because no one else wanted it. Everyone was promised a spot on a geological survey if they wanted one, and Phyllis and Mary and the rest of the Houston crowd were given assurances that the construction of base camp would go according to the plans made in Houston. They intended to work at the base to see that it happened that way. "Fine, fine," Frank snarled at the end of one of these meetings. "We're all going to be on Mars. Do we really have to fight like this over what we're going to do there?" "That's life," Arkady said cheerfully. "On Mars or not, life goes on." Frank's jaw was clenched. "I came here to get away from this kind of thing." Arkady shook his head. "You certainly did not. This is your life, Frank. What would you do without it?"